he received. "I know what happened," the Queen affirmed. "If you know it too, then I guess you are the one who helped him." "Yes. It is only because of me he returned to you in one piece and well." "I am grateful to you then, Archeon of Erlenwald. That gratitude is none the lesser for the fact that Rognar, gentleman of my heart and bed, has left this world. Tell me, if the implication that your aid was not disinterested does not offend another of your knightly vows, how I can express my gratitude?"
"You well know my aid was not disinterested. You know, too, that I have come to collect the promised reward for saving the king's life."
"Oh, yes."
Calanthe smiled, but green sparks lit up her eyes.
"So, you found a man at the bottom of a ravine, defenceless, wounded, at the mercy of vipers and monsters. And only when he promised you a reward did you help. And if he didn't want to or couldn't promise you something, you'd have left him there. And to this day I wouldn't know where his bones lay. How noble. No doubt your actions were guided by a particularly chivalrous vow at the time."
The murmur around the hall grew louder.
"And today you come for your reward, Archeon," continued the Queen,
smiling even more ominously.
"After 15 years? No doubt you're counting the interest accrued over this period. This isn't the Dwarves' Bank, Archeon. You say Rognar promised you a reward. Ah, well, it will be difficult to get him to pay you. It would be simpler to send you to him, into the other world, to reach an agreement over who owes what. I loved my husband too dearly, Archeon, to forget that I could have lost him then, 15 years ago, if he hadn't chosen to bargain with you. The thought of it arouses rather ill feeling towards you. Masked newcomer, do you know that here in Sintra, in my castle and in my power, you are just as helpless and close to death as Rognar was then, at the bottom of the ravine? What will you propose, what price, what reward will you offer, if I promise you will leave here alive?"
The medallion on Geralt's neck twitched. The Witcher caught Mousak's clearly uneasy gaze. He shook his head a little and raised his eyebrows questioningly. The druid also shook his head and, with a barely perceptible move of his curly beard, indicated Urquhart. Geralt wasn't sure.
"Your words, Your Majesty," called Urquhart, "are calculated to frighten me, to kindle the anger of the honourable gentleman gathered here and the contempt of your pretty daughter, Pavetta. But above all, your words are untrue, and you know it."
"You accuse me of lying like a dog?"
An ugly grimace crept across Calanthe's lips.
"You know very well, Your Majesty," the newcomer continued adamantly, "what happened then in Erlenwald. You know Rognar, once saved, vowed of his own will to give me whatever I asked for. I call upon everyone to witness my words. When the king, rescued from his misadventure, reached his retinue, he asked me what I demanded, and I answered. I asked him to promise me whatever he had left at home without knowing or expecting it. The king swore it would be so, and on his return to the castle he found you, Calanthe, in labour. Yes, Your Majesty, I waited for 15 years, and the interest on my reward has grown. Today, I look at the beautiful Pavetta, and see that the wait has been worth it. Gentlemen and knights, some of you have come to Sintra to ask for the princess's hand. You have come in vain. From the day of her birth, by the power of the royal oath, the beautiful Pavetta has belonged to me."
An uproar burst forth among the guests. Some shouted, someone swore, someone else thumped his fist on the table and knocked the dishes over. Vealdhill of Strept pulled a knife out of the roast lamb and waved it about. Krach and Krait bent over, was clearly trying to break a plank from the table trestle.
"That's unheard of!" yelled Visigerd. "What proof do you have? Proof!"
"The Queen's face," exclaimed Urquhart, extending his hand, "is the best proof."
Pavetta sat motionless, not raising her head. The air was growing thick with something very strange. The Witcher's medallion was tearing at its chain under the tunic. He saw the Queen summon a page and whisper a short command. Geralt couldn't hear it, but he was puzzled by the surprise on the boy's face and the fact that the command had to be repeated. The page ran towards the exit. The uproar at the table continued as Aes Tyrsach turned to the Queen.
"Calanthe," he said calmly, "is what is his true."
"And if it is?"
the Queen muttered through her teeth, biting her lips and picking at the green sash on her shoulder.
"So what?"
"If what he says is true," Aes frowned, "then the promise will have to be kept."
"Is that so?
Or am I to understand," the islander asked grimly, "that you treat all promises this lightly, including those which have etched themselves so deeply in my memory?"
Geralt, who had never expected to see Calanthe blush deeply with tears in her eyes and trembling lips, was surprised.
"Aes," whispered the Queen, "this is different."
"Is it, really?"
"Oh, you son of a bitch!"
Krach and Crete yelled unexpectedly, jumping up.
"The last fool who said I'd acted in vain was pinched apart by crabs at the bottom of Alanker Bay. I didn't sail here from Skellige to return empty-handed. A suitor has turned up, some son of a trollop. Someone bring me a sword and give that idiot some iron. We'll soon see who..."
"Maybe you could just shut up, Krach,"
Aes snapped scathingly, resting both fists on the table.
"Dregbondu, I render you responsible for his future behaviour." "And are you going to silence me too, Tyrsach?"
shouted Rainfarn of Atrey, standing up.
"Who is going to stop me from washing the insult thrown at my prince away with blood? And his son, Vindhalm, the only man worthy of Pavetta's hand and bait? Bring the swords! I'll show that Archaean, or whatever he's called, how we of Atrey take revenge for such abuse. I wonder whether anybody or anything could hold me back."
"Yes, regard for good manners," said Aes Tyrsach calmly. "It is not proper to start a fight here, or challenge anyone without permission from the lady of the house.
What is this? It's the throne room of Sintra, an inn where you can punch each other's heads and stab each other with knives as the fancy takes you."
Everybody started to shout again, to curse and swear and wave their arms about. But the uproar suddenly stopped, as if cut by a knife, at the short, furious roar of an enraged bison.
"Yes," said Kukudak,
clearing his throat and rising from his chair.
"Aes has it wrong. This doesn't even look like an inn anymore. It's more like a zoo, so a bison should be at home here. Honourable Calanthe, allow me to offer my opinion."
"A great many people, I see," said Calanthe in a drawling voice, "have an opinion on this problem, and are offering it even without my permission. Strange that you aren't interested in mine, and in my opinion, this bloody castle will sooner collapse on my head than I give my Pavetta to this crank. I haven't the least intention..."
"Ragnar's oath,"
Erkian began, but the Queen silenced him, banging her golden goblet on the table.
"Ragnar's oath means about as much to me as last year's snows. And as for you, Erkian, I haven't decided whether to allow Krach or Rainfarn to meet you outside, or to simply hang you. You're greatly influencing my decision with your interruption."
Geralt, still disturbed by the way his medallion was quivering, looked around the hall. Suddenly, he saw Pavetta's eyes, emerald green like her mother's. The princess was no longer hiding them beneath her long lashes. She swept them from Mausack to the Witcher, ignoring the others. Mausack, bent over, was wriggling and muttering something. Kukudak, still standing, cleared his throat meaningfully.
"Speak," the Queen nodded, "but be brief."
"As you command, your majesty. Noble Calanthe, and you, knights. Indeed, Archaon of Erlenwald made a strange request of King Ragnar, a strange reward to demand when the king offered him his wish. But let us not pretend we've never heard of such requests, of the lore of surprise, as old as humanity itself, of the price a man who saves another can demand, of the granting of a seemingly impossible wish. You will give me the first thing that comes to greet you. It might be a dog, you'll say, a halberdier at the gate, even a mother-in-law, impatient to holler at a son-in-law when he returns home. Or you'll give me what you find at home, yet don't expect. After a long journey, honourable gentleman and an unexpected return, this could be a lover in the wife's bed. But sometimes it's a child. A child marked out by destiny.
Briefly, Kukudak, Calanthe frowned.
As you command. Sars, have you not heard of children marked out by destiny? Was not the legendary hero Zatrit Verruter given to the dwarves as a child because he was the first person his father met on his return? And Mad Day, who demanded a traveller give him what he left at home without knowing it. That surprise was the famous Supree, who later liberated Mad Day from the curse which weighed him down. Remember Zivalina, who became the queen of Metina with the help of the gnome Rumpelstilt, and in return promised her firstborn. Zivalina didn't keep her promise when Rumpelstilt came for his reward, and by using spells she forced him to run away. Not long after that, both she and the child died of the plague. You do not dice with destiny with impunity.
Don't threaten me, Kukudak, Calanthe grimaced. Midnight is close, the time for ghosts. Can you remember any more legends from your undoubtedly difficult childhood? If not, then sit down.
I ask your grace.
The Baron turned up his long whiskers.
To allow me to remain standing. I'd like to remind everybody of another legend. It's an old, forgotten legend. We've all probably heard it in our difficult childhoods. In this legend, the kings kept their promises, and we, poor vassals, are only bound to kings by the royal word. Treaties, alliances, our privileges and fiefs all rely on it. And now? Are we to doubt all this? Doubt the inviolability of the king's word? Wait until it is worth as much as yesteryear's snow. If this is how things are to be, then a difficult old age awaits us after our difficult childhoods. Whose side are you on, Kirkudak?
Hollered Rainfarn of Itra.
Silence! Let him speak.
This cackler, full of hot air, insults her majesty!
The Baron of Teague is right. Silence!
Calanthe said suddenly, getting up.
Let him finish.
I thank you, graciously, bowed Kukudak. But I have just finished.
Silence fell, strange after the commotion his words had caused. Calanthe was still standing. Geralt didn't think anyone else had noticed her handshake as she wiped her brow.
My lords,
she said finally,
you deserve an explanation. Yes, this Archaon speaks the truth. Rognar did swear to give him that which he did not expect. It looks as if our lamented king was an oaf as far as a woman's affairs are concerned, and couldn't be trusted to count to nine. He confessed the truth on his deathbed because he knew what I'd do to him if he'd admitted it earlier. He knew what a mother whose child is disposed of so recklessly is capable of.
The knights and magnates remained silent. Archaon stood motionless, like a spiked iron statue.
And Kukudak? Continued Calanthe. Well, Kukudak has reminded me that I am not a mother, but a queen. Very well, then. As queen, I shall convene a council tomorrow. Sintra is not a tyranny. The council will decide whether a dead king's oath is to decide the fate of the successor to the throne. It will decide whether Pavetter and the Stone of Sintra are to be given to a stranger, or to act according to the kingdom's interest.
Calanthe was silent for a moment, looking askance at Geralt.
And as for the noble knights who have come to Sintra in the hope of the princess's hand, it only remains for me to express my deep regret at the cruel disrespect and dishonour they have experienced here, at the ridicule poured on them. I am not to blame.
Amidst the hum of voices which rumbled through the guests, the Witcher managed to pick out Erst Chirsach's whisper.
On all the gods of the sea, sighed the islander. This isn't befitting. This is open incitement to bloodshed. Calanthe, you're simply setting them against each other. Be quiet, Aist, hissed the queen furiously, because I'll get angry.
Mousek's black eyes flashed as, with a glance, the druid indicated Rainfarn of Atre, who, with a gloomy, grimacing face, was preparing to stand. Geralt reacted immediately, standing up first and banging the chair noisily.
"Maybe it will prove unnecessary to convene the council," he said in ringing tones.
Everyone grew silent, watching him with astonishment. Geralt felt Pavetta's emerald eyes on him. He felt Urquhart's gaze fall on him from behind the lattice of his black visor. And he felt the force surging like a flood wave and solidifying in the air. He saw how, under the influence of this force, the smoke from the torches and oil lamps was taking on fantastic forms. He knew that Moussac saw it too. He also knew that nobody else saw it.
"I said," he repeated calmly, "that convening the council may not prove necessary. You understand what I have in mind, Urquhart of Erlenwald."
The spiked knight took two grating steps forward.
"I do," he said, his words hollow beneath his helmet. "It would take a fool not to understand. I heard what the merciful and noble Lady Calanthe said a moment ago. She has found an excellent way of getting rid of me. I accept your challenge, knight unknown to me."
"I don't recall challenging you," said Geralt. "I don't intend to duel you, Urquhart of Erlenwald."
"Geralt,"
called Calanthe, twisting her lips and forgetting to call the witcher Ravix.
"Don't overdo it. Don't put my patience to the test."
"Or mine,"
added Rainfarn ominously. Krach and Kreet growled, and East Tirthach meaningfully showed him a clenched fist. Krach growled even louder.
"Everyone heard," spoke Geralt. "Baron Teig, tell us about the famous heroes, taken from their parents on the strength of the same oath that Urquhart received from King Rognar. But why should anyone want such an oath? You know the answer, Urquhart of Erlenwald. It creates a powerful, indissoluble tie of destiny between the person demanding the oath and its object, the child's surprise. Such a child, marked by blind fate, can be destined for extraordinary things. It can play an incredibly important role in the life of the person to whom fate has tied it. That is why, Urquhart, you demanded the prize you claim today. You don't want the throne of Sintra. You want the princess."
"It is exactly as you say, knight unknown to me."
Urquhart laughed out loud.
"That is exactly what I claim. Give me the one who is my destiny."
"That," said Geralt, "will have to be proved."
"You dare doubt it? After the queen confirmed the truth of my words? After what you've just said?"
"Yes, because you didn't tell us everything.
Rognar knew the power of the Law of Surprise and the gravity of the oath he took. And he took it because he knew law and custom have a power which protects such oaths, ensuring they are only fulfilled when the force of destiny confirms them. I declare, Urquhart, that you have no right to the princess as yet. You will win her only when..."
"When what?"
"When the princess herself agrees to leave with you. This is what the Law of Surprise states. It is the child's, not the parents' consent which confirms the oath, which proves that the child was born under the shadow of destiny. That's why you returned after 15 years, Urquhart, and that's the condition King Rognar stipulated in his oath."
"Who are you?"
"I am Geralt of Rivia."
"Who are you, Geralt of Rivia, to claim to be an oracle in matters of laws and customs?"
"He knows the law better than anyone else,"
Moussac said in a hoarse voice, "because it applied to him once.
He was taken from his home because he was what his father hadn't expected to find on his return. Because he was destined for other things. And by the power of destiny, he became what he is."
"And what is he?"
"A witcher."
In the silence that reigned, the guardhouse bell struck, announcing midnight in a dull tone. Everyone shuddered and raised their heads. Moussac watched Geralt with surprise. But it was Urquhart who flinched most noticeably and moved uneasily. His hands, clad in their armour gauntlets, fell to his sides lifelessly, and the spiked helmet swayed unsteadily. The strange, unknown force suddenly grew thicker, filling the hall like a grey mist.
"It's true," said Calanthe. "Geralt, present here, is a witcher. His trade is worthy of respect and esteem. He has sacrificed himself to protect us from monsters and nightmares born in the night, though sent by powers ominous and harmful to man. He kills the horrors and monsters that await us in the forests and ravines, and those which have the audacity to enter our dwellings."
Urquhart was silent.
"And so,"
continued the Queen, raising her ringed hand,
"let the law be fulfilled. Let the oath which you, Urquhart of Erlenwald, insist should be satisfied, be satisfied. Midnight has struck. Your vow no longer binds you. Lift your visor, before my daughter expresses her will, before she decides her destiny. Let her see your face. We all wish to see your face."
Urquhart of Erlenwald slowly raised his armoured hand, pulled at the helmet's fastenings, grabbed it by the iron horn, and threw it against the floor with a crash. Someone shouted, someone swore, someone sucked in their breath with a whistle. On the Queen's face appeared a wicked, very wicked smile, a cruel smile of triumph. Above the wide, semicircular breastplate, two bulbous black button eyes looked out, eyes set to either side of a blunt, elongated muzzle covered in reddish bristles and full of sharp white fangs. Urquhart's head and neck bristled with a brush of short grey twitching prickles.
"This is how I look," spoke the creature, "which you well knew, Calanthe. Rognar, in telling you of his oath, wouldn't have omitted describing me. Urquhart of Erlenwald, to whom, despite my appearance, Rognar swore his oath. You prepared well for my arrival, Queen. Your own vassals have pointed out your haughty and contemptuous refusal to keep Rognar's word. When your attempt to set the other's suitors on me didn't succeed, you still had a killer witcher in reserve, ready at your right hand. And finally, common, low deceit. You wanted to humiliate me, Calanthe. No, that it is yourself you have humiliated. Enough!"
Calanthe stood up and rested her clenched fist on her hip.
"Let's put an end to this. Pavetta, you see who, or rather what, is standing in front of you, claiming you for himself. In accordance with the law of surprise and eternal custom, the decision is yours. Answer. One word from you is enough. Yes, and you become the property, the conquest of this monster. No, and you will never have to see him again."
The force pulsating in the hall was squeezing Geralt's temples like an iron vice, buzzing in his ears, making the hair on his neck stand on end. The witcher looked at Mousesack's whitening knuckles clenched at the edge of the table, at the trickle of sweat running down the Queen's cheek, at the breadcrumbs on the table moving like insects, forming runes, dispersing, and again gathering into one word. Careful.
"Pavetta," Calanthe repeated. "Answer. Do you choose to leave with this creature?"
Pavetta raised her head.
"Yes."
The force filling the hall echoed her, rumbling hollowly in the arches of the vault. No one, absolutely no one, made the slightest sound. Calanthe, very slowly, collapsed into her throne. Her face was completely expressionless.
"Everyone heard!"
Urquhart's calm voice resounded in the silence.
"You too, Calanthe. As did you, witcher, cunning, hired thug. My rights have been established. Truth and destiny have triumphed over lies and deviousness. What do you have left, noble queen, disguised witcher? Cold steel?"
No one answered.
"I'd like to leave with Pavetta immediately," continued Urquhart,
his bristles stirring as he snapped his jaw shut.
"But I won't deny myself one small pleasure. It is you, Calanthe, who will lead your daughter here to me and place her white hand in mine.
Calanthe slowly turned her head in the witch's direction. Her eyes expressed a command. Geralt didn't move, sensing that the force condensing in the air was concentrated on him, only on him. Now he understood. The queen's eyes narrowed, her lips quivered.
"What? What's this?" yelled Krachan Kreet, jumping up. "Her white hand, and his! The princess with this bristly stinker! With this pig snout!"
"And I wanted to fight him like a knight," Rainfarn chimed in. "This horror! This beast! Loose the dogs on him! The dogs!"
"Guards!" cried Calanthe.
Everything happened at once. Krachan Kreet seized a knife from the table and knocked his chair over with a crash. Obeying Aist's command, Trigbon Dhu, without a thought, whacked the back of his head with his bagpipes as hard as he could. Krach dropped onto the table between a sturgeon in grey sauce and the few remaining arched ribs of a roast boar. Rainfarn leapt towards Urkion, flashing a dagger drawn from his sleeve. Kakudak, springing up, kicked a stool under his feet, which Rainfarn jumped agilely. But a moment's delay was enough. Urkion deceived him with a short feint and forced him to his knees with a mighty blow from his armoured fist. Kakudak fell to snatch the dagger from Rainfarn, but was stopped by Prince Vindhelm, who clung to his thigh like a bloodhound. Guards, armed with gisarm and lances, ran in from the entrance. Calanthe, upright and threatening, with an authoritative abrupt gesture, indicated Urkion to them. Pavetta started to shout, Aist Tirsach to curse. Everyone jumped up, not quite knowing what to do.
"Kill him!"
shouted the queen. Urkion, huffing angrily and baring his fangs, turned to face the attacking guards. He was unarmed, but clad in spiked steel, from which the points of the gisarm bounced with a clang. But the blows knocked him back, straight into Rainfarn, who was just getting up, and immobilized him by grabbing his legs. Urkion let out a roar, and with his iron elbow guards, deflected the blades aimed at his head. Rainfarn jabbed him with his dagger, but the blade slid off the breastplate. The guards, crossing their spear shafts, pinned him to the sculpted chimney. Rainfarn, who was hanging onto his belt, found a chink in the armour and dug the dagger into it. Urkion curled up.
"Duni!"
Pavetta shrilled as she jumped onto the chair. The witcher, sword in hand, sprang onto the table and ran towards the fighting men, knocking plates, dishes and goblets all over the place. He knew there wasn't much time. Pavetta's cries were sounding more and more unnatural. Rainfarn was raising his dagger to stab again. Geralt cut, springing from the table into a crouch. Rainfarn wailed and staggered to the wall. The witcher spun, and with the centre of his blade, slashed a guard who was trying to dig the sharp tongue of his lance between Urkion's apron and breastplate. The guard tumbled to the ground, losing his helmet. More guards came running in from the entrance.
"This is not befitting!" roared Aist Tirsach, grabbing a chair.
He shattered the unwieldy piece of furniture against the floor with great force, and, with what remained in his hand, threw himself at those advancing on Urkion. Urkion, caught by two gisarm hooks at the same time, collapsed with a clang, cried out, and huffed as he was dragged along the floor. A third guard raised his lance to stab down, and Geralt cut him in the temple with the point of his sword. Those dragging Urkion stepped back quickly, throwing down their gisarm, while those approaching from the entrance backed away from the remnants of chair brandished by Aist like the magic sword Balmur in the hand of the legendary Zatretavaruta. Pavetta's cries reached a peak and suddenly broke off. Geralt, sensing what was about to happen, fell to the floor, watching for a greenish flash. He felt an excruciating pain in his ears, heard a terrible crash, and a horrifying wail ripped from numerous throats. And then the princess's even, monotonous and vibrating cry. The table, scattering dishes and food all around, was rising and spinning. Heavy chairs were flying around the hall and shattering against the walls. Tapestries and hangings were flapping, raising clouds of dust. Cries and the dry crack of gisarm shafts, snapping like sticks, came from the entrance. The throne, with Calanthe sitting on it, sprang up and flew across the hall like an arrow, smashing into the wall with a crash and falling apart. The queen slid to the floor like a ragged puppet. Aedh Tirsach, barely on his feet, threw himself towards her, took her in his arms, and sheltered her from the hail, pelting against the walls and floor with his body. Geralt, grasping the medallion in his hand, slithered as quickly as he could towards Marsak, miraculously still on his knees, who was lifting a short hawthorn wand with a rat skull affixed to the tip. On the wall behind the druid, a tapestry depicting the siege and fire of Fortress Ortagar was burning with very real flames. Pavetta wailed. Turning round and round, she lashed everything and everybody with her cries as if with a whip. Anyone who tried to stand tumbled to the ground or was flattened against the wall. An enormous silver sauceboat in the shape of a many-oared vessel with an upturned bow came whistling through the air in front of Geralt's eyes and knocked down the voivode with a hard-to-remember name just as he was trying to dodge it. Plaster rained down silently as the table rotated beneath the ceiling, with Krach and Krait flattened on it and throwing down vile curses. Geralt crawled to Mausak, and they hid behind the heap formed by Fodcat of Strept, a barrel of beer, Drogodar, a chair, and Drogodar's lute.
"It's pure primordial force!" the druid yelled over the racket and clatter. "She's got no control over it!" "I know!" Geralt yelled back.
A roast pheasant with a few striped feathers still stuck in its rump fell from nowhere and thumped him in the back.
"She has to be restrained! The walls are starting to crack! I can see!" "Ready?"
"Yes!"
"One, two, now!"
They both hit her simultaneously, Geralt with the sign of Ard, and Mausak with a terrible, three-staged curse, powerful enough to make the floor melt. The chair on which the princess was standing disintegrated into splinters. Pavetta barely noticed. She hung in the air within a transparent green sphere. Without ceasing to shout, she turned her head towards them, and her petite face shrunk into a sinister grimace.
"By all the demons!" roared Mausak.
"Careful!"
shouted the Witcher, curling up.
"Block her, Mausak! Block her, or it's the end of us!"
The table thudded heavily to the ground, shattering its trestle and everything beneath it. Krach and Krait, who was lying on the table, was thrown into the air. A heavy rain of plates and remnants of food fell. Crystal carafes exploded as they hit the ground. The cornice broke away from the wall, rumbling like thunder, making the floors of the castle quake.
"Everything's letting go!" Mausak
shouted, aiming his wand at the princess.
"The whole force is going to fall on us!"
Geralt, with a blow of his sword, deflected a huge double-pronged fork which was flying straight at the druid.
"Block it, Mausak!"
Emerald eyes sent two flashes of green lightning at them. They coiled into blinding, whirling funnels, from the centres of which the force, like a battering ram which exploded the skull, put out the eyes and paralysed the breath, descended on them. Together with the force, glass, majolica, platters, candlesticks, bones, nibbled loaves of bread, planks, slats, and smouldering firewood from the hearth poured over them. Crying wildly, like a great capercaillie, Castellan Haxo flew over their heads. The enormous head of a boiled carp splattered against Geralt's chest on the bare passant sable and damsel of Forehorn. Through Mausak's wall-shattering curses, through his own shouting and the wailing of the wounded, the din, clatter and racket, through Pavetta's wailing, the Witcher suddenly heard the most terrible sound. Kukudak, on his knees, was strangling Dregbon Du's bagpipes with his hands, while, with his head thrown back, he shouted over the monstrous sounds emerging from the bag, wailed and roared, cackled and croaked, bawled and squawked in a cacophony of sounds made by all known, unknown, domestic, wild and mythical animals. Pavetta fell silent, horrified, and looked at the Baron with her mouth agape. The force eased off abruptly.
"Now!" yelled Mausak, waving his wand. "Now, Witcher!"
They hit her. The greenish sphere surrounding the princess burst under their blow like a soap bubble, and the vacuum instantly sucked in the force raging through the room. Pavetta flopped heavily to the ground and started to weep. After the pandemonium, a moment's silence rang in her ears. Then, with difficulty, laboriously, voices started to break through the rubble and destruction, through the broken furniture and the inert bodies.
"Huachopiers! Kilbranach malachuch!"
spat Krach and Krait, spraying blood from his bitten lip.
"Control yourself, Krach," said Mousesack with effort, shaking Buckwheat from his front. "There are women present."
"Calanthe, my beloved, my Calanthe," East Chirsack said in the pauses between kisses. The Queen opened her eyes, but didn't try to free herself from his embrace.
"East, people are watching," she said.
"Let them watch."
"Would somebody care to explain what that was?"
asked Marshal Visigerd, crawling from beneath a fallen tapestry.
"No," said the Witcher.
"A doctor!"
Vindhalm of Atre, leaning over Rainfarn, shouted shrilly.
"Water!"
Vealdhill, one of the brothers from Strept, called, stifling the smouldering tapestry with his jacket.
"Water! Quickly!"
"And beer!"
Kukudak croaked. A few knights, still able to stand, were trying to lift Pavetta, but she pushed their hands aside, got up on her own, and, unsteadily, walked towards the hearth. There, with his back resting against the wall, sat Urkion, awkwardly trying to remove his blood-smeared armour.
"The youth of today," snorted Mousesack, looking in their direction. "They start early. They've only got one thing on their minds."
"What's that?"
"Didn't you know, Witcher, that a virgin, that is, one who's untouched, wouldn't be able to use the Force?"
"To hell with her virginity," muttered Geralt. "Where did she get such a gift, anyway? Neither Calanthe nor Rognar."
"She inherited it, missing a generation and no mistake," said the Druid. "Her grandmother, Adalia, could raise a drawbridge with a twitch of her eyebrows. Hey, Geralt, look at that! She still hasn't had enough!"
Calanthe, supported by East Tirsak's arm, indicated the wounded Urkion to the guards. Geralt and Mousesack approached quickly but unnecessarily. The guards recoiled from the semi-reclining figure, and whispering and muttering, backed away. Urkion's monstrous snout softened, blurred, and was beginning to lose its contours. The spikes and bristles rippled and became black, shiny, wavy hair and a beard, which bordered a pale, angular, masculine face, dominated by a prominent nose.
"What?"
stammered East Tirsach.
"Who's that? Urkion?"
"Duni,"
said Pavetta softly. Calanthe turned away with pursed lips.
"Cursed," murmured East. "But how?"
"Midnight has struck," said the Witcher. "Just this minute. The bell we heard before was early. The bell ringer's mistake. Am I right, Calanthe?"
"Right. Right,"
groaned the man called Duni, answering instead of the Queen, who had no intention of replying anyway.
"But maybe instead of standing there talking, someone could help me with this armour and call a doctor. That madman Rainfarn stabbed me under the ribs."
"What do we need a doctor for?"
said Mousesack, taking out his wand.
"Enough."
Calanthe straightened and raised her head proudly.
"Enough of this. When all this is over, I want to see you in my chamber, all of you, as you stand. East, Pavetta, Mousesack, Geralt, and you. Duni. Mousesack?"
"Yes, your majesty."
"That wand of yours. I've bruised my backbone. And thereabouts."
"At your command, your majesty."
Part 3. "A curse," continued Duni, rubbing his temple.
"Since birth. I never found a reason for it, or who did it to me. From midnight to dawn, an ordinary man. From dawn, you saw what. Ekerspark, my father, wanted to hide it. People are superstitious in Mecht. Spells and curses in the royal family could prove fatal for the dynasty. One of my father's knights took me away from court and brought me up. The two of us wandered around the world, the knight errant and his squire, and later, when he died, I journeyed alone. I can't remember who told me that a child's surprise could free me from the curse. Not long after that, I met Rognar. The rest you know."
"The rest we know or can guess,"
nodded Calanthe.
"Especially that you didn't wait the 15 years agreed upon with Rognar, but turned my daughter's head before that. Pavetta, since when?"
The princess lowered her head and raised a finger.
"There! You little sorceress! Right under my nose! Let me just find out who let him into the castle at night,
Let me at the ladies-in-waiting you went gathering primroses with. Primroses, damn it! Well, what am I to do with you now?
Calanthe, began East.
Hold on, Tirsa. I haven't finished yet. Duny, the matter's become very complicated. You've been with Pavetta for a year now, and what? And nothing. So, you negotiated the oath from the wrong father. Destiny has made a fool of you. What irony, as Geralt of Rivia present here is wont to say. To hell with destiny, oaths and irony, grimaced Duny. I love Pavetta, and she loves me, that's all that counts. You can't stand in the way of our happiness. I can, Duny, I can, and how.
Calanthe smiled one of her unfeeling smiles.
You're lucky I don't want to. I have a certain debt towards you, Duny. I've made up my mind. I ought to ask your forgiveness, but I hate doing that. So I'm giving you Pavetta, and we'll be quits.
Pavetta? You haven't changed your mind, have you?
The princess shook her head eagerly.
Thank you, Your Majesty. Thank you, smiled Duny. You're a wise and generous queen.
Of course I am.
And beautiful. And beautiful.
You can both stay in Sintra if you wish. The people here are less superstitious than the inhabitants of Mecht, and adjust to things quicker. Besides, even as Archean, you were quite pleasant. But you can't count on having the throne just yet. I intend to reign a little longer, beside the new king of Sintra. The noble East Tirsach of Skellige has made me a very interesting proposition.
Calanthe?
Yes, East, I accept. I've never before listened to a confession of love while lying on the floor amid fragments of my own throne, but... How did you put it, Duny? This is all that counts, and I don't advise anyone to stand in the way of my happiness. And you? What are you staring at? I'm not as old as you think.
Today's youth, muttered Mausack.
The apple doesn't fall far.
What are you muttering, sorcerer?
Nothing, ma'am.
Good. While we're at it, I've got a proposition for you, Mausack. Pavetta's going to need a teacher. She ought to learn how to use her gift. I like this castle, and I'd prefer it to remain standing.
It might fall apart at my talented daughter's next attack of hysteria. How about it, Druid?
I'm honoured.
I think... The Queen turned her head towards the window. It's dawn. Time to... She suddenly turned to where Pavetta and Duny were whispering to each other, holding hands, their foreheads all but touching.
Duny?
Yes, Your Majesty.
Do you hear? It's dawn. It's already light. And you...
Geralt glanced at Mausack, and both started laughing.
And why are you so happy, sorceress? Can't you see?
We can. We can, Geralt assured her.
We were waiting until you saw for yourself, snorted Mausack. I was wondering when you'd catch on.
To what?
That you've lifted the curse. It's you who's lifted it, said the Witcher. The moment you said, I'm giving you Pavetta, destiny was fulfilled.
Exactly, confirmed the Druid.
Oh, gods, said Duny slowly. So, finally.
Damn, I thought I'd be happier that some sort of trumpets would play, or force of habit.
Your Majesty, thank you. Pavetta, do you hear?
Said the princess, without raising her eyes.
And so,
sighed Calanthe, looking at Geralt with tired eyes,
all's well that ends well. Don't you agree, Witcher? The curse has been lifted. Two weddings are on their way. It'll take about a month to repair the throne room. There are four dead, countless wounded, and Rainfarnham Atrey is half dead. Let's celebrate. Do you know, Witcher, there was a moment when I wanted to have you.
I know.
But now I have to do you justice. I demanded a result, and got one. Sintra is allied to Skellige. My daughter's marrying the right man. For a moment, I thought all this would have been fulfilled according to destiny anyway, even if I hadn't had you brought in for the feast and sat you next to me. But I was wrong. Rainfarn's dagger could have changed destiny. And Rainfarn was stopped by a sword held by a witcher. You've done an honest job, Geralt. Now it's a question of price. Tell me what you want.
Hold on, said Dooney, fingering his bandaged side. A question of price, you say? It is I who am in debt. It's up to me. Don't interrupt. Calanthe narrowed her eyes. Your mother-in-law hates being interrupted. Remember that. And you should know that you're not in any debt. It so happens that you are the subject of my agreement with Geralt. I said we're quits, and I don't see the sense of my having to endlessly apologise to you for it. But the agreement still binds me. Well, Geralt, your price.
Very well, said the Witcher. I ask for your green sash, Calanthe. May it always remind me of the colour of the eyes of the most beautiful queen I have ever known.
Calanthe laughed and unfastened her emerald necklace.
This trinket, she said, has stones of the right hue. Keep it, and the memory.
May I speak? Asked Dooney modestly.
But of course, son-in-law, please do.
I still say I am in your debt, Witcher. It is my life that Rainfarn's dagger endangered. I would have been beaten to death by the guards without you. If there's talk of a price, then I should be the one to pay. I assure you, I can afford it.
What do you ask, Geralt? Dooney, said Geralt slowly. A Witcher who is asked such a question has to ask to have it repeated.
I repeat, therefore, because you see, I am in your debt for still another reason. When I found out who you were, there in the hall, I hated you and thought very badly of you. I took you for a blind, bloodthirsty tool, for someone who kills coldly and without question, who wipes his blade clean of blood and counts the cash. But I've become convinced that the witch's profession is worthy of respect. You protect us, not only from the evil lurking in the darkness, but also from that which lies within ourselves. It's a shame there are so few of you.
Calanthe smiled. For the first time that night, Geralt was inclined to believe it was genuine.
My son-in-law has spoken well. I have to add two words to what he said. Precisely two. Forgive, Geralt.
And I, said Dooney, ask again. What do you ask for?
Dooney, said Geralt seriously. Calanthe, Pavetta, and you, righteous knight Tirsach, future king of Sintra. In order to become a Witcher, you have to be born in the shadow of destiny. And very few are born like that. That's why there are so few of us. We're growing old, dying, without anyone to pass our knowledge, our gifts, onto. We lack successors. And this world is full of evil, which waits for the day none of us are left.
Geralt? Whispered Calanthe.
Yes. You're not wrong, Queen. Dooney, you will give me that which you already have, but do not know. I'll return to Sintra in 6 years to see if destiny has been kind to me.
Pavetta?
Dooney opened his eyes wide.
Surely you're not... Pavetta! Exclaimed Calanthe. Are you? Are you?
The princess lowered her eyes and blushed, then replied.
The Voice of Reason 5.
Geralt? Hey, are you there?
He raised his head from the coarse, yellowed pages of The History of the World by Roderick de Novembre, an interesting, if controversial, work which he had been studying since the previous day.
Yes, I am. What's happened, Nenica? Do you need me?
You've got a guest.
Again? Who is it this time? Duke Herivard himself?
No. It's Dandelion this time, your fellow. That idler parasite and good-for-nothing. That priest of art. The bright, shining star of the ballad and love poem. As usual, he's radiant with fame, puffed up like a pig's bladder and stinking of beer. Do you want to see him?
Of course. He's my friend, after all.
Nenica, peeved, shrugged her shoulders.
I can't understand that friendship. He's your absolute opposite.
Opposites attract.
Obviously. There, he's coming.
She indicated with her head, your famous poet.
He really is a famous poet, Nenica. Surely you're not going to claim you've never heard his ballads.
I've heard them.
The priestess winced.
Yes, indeed. Well, I don't know much about it, but maybe the ability to jump from touching lyricism to obscenities so easily is a talent. Never mind. Forgive me, but I won't keep you company. I'm not in the mood for either his poetry or his vulgar jokes.
A peal of laughter and the strumming of a lute resounded in the corridor, and there on the threshold of the library stood Dandelion, in a lilac jerkin with lace cuffs, his hat askew. The troubadour bowed exaggeratedly at the sight of Nenica, the heron feather pinned to his hat, sweeping the floor.
"My deepest respects, venerable mother," he whined stupidly. "Praise be the great Melitela and her priestesses, the springs of virtue and wisdom."
"Stop talking bullshit," snorted Nenica, "and don't call me mother. The very idea that you could be my son fills me with horror."
She turned on her heel and left, her trailing robe rustling. Dandelion, aping her, sketched a parody bow.
"She hasn't changed a bit," he said cheerfully. "She still can't take a joke. She's furious because I chattered a bit to the gatekeeper when I got here. A pretty blonde with long lashes and a virgin's plait reaching down to a cute little bottom, which it would be a sin not to pinch. So I did, and Nenica, who had just arrived... Ah, what the deuce! Greetings, Geralt!"
"Greetings, Dandelion. How did you know I was here?" The poet straightened himself and yanked his trousers up.
"I was in Vichim," he said. "I heard about the Strigger and that you were wounded. I guessed where you had come to recuperate. I see you're well now. Are you?"
"You see correctly. But try explaining that to Nenica. Sit. Let's talk."
Dandelion sat and peeped into the book lying on the lectern. "History?" he smiled. "Roderick de Novembre? I've read him, I have. History was second on my list of favourite subjects when I was studying at the Academy in Oxenford."
"What was the first?"
"Geography," said the poet seriously. "The atlas was bigger, and it was easier to hide a demijohn of vodka behind it."
Geralt laughed dryly, got up, removed Lunin and Tyrus's The Arcane Mysteries of Magic and Alchemy from the shelf, and pulled a round-bellied vessel wrapped in straw from behind the bulky volume and into the light of day.
"Oh-ho!"
The bard visibly cheered up.
"Wisdom and inspiration, I see, are still to be found in libraries. Oh, I like this. Plum, isn't it?" "Yes, this is true alchemy. This is a philosopher's stone well worth studying. Your health, brother." "Oh, it's strong as the plague."
"What brings you here?"
Geralt took the demijohn over from the poet, took a sip and started to cough, fingering his bandaged neck.
"Where are you going?"
"Nowhere. That is, I could go where you're going. I could keep you company. Do you intend staying here long?"
"Not long. The local duke let it be known I'm not welcome."
"Herivard?"
Dandelion knew all the kings, princes, lords and feudal lords from Yaruga to the Dragon Mountains.
"Don't you give a damn. He won't dare fall foul of Nenica or Melitela. The people would set fire to his castle."
"I don't want any trouble, and I've been sitting here for too long anyway. I'm going south, Dandelion. Far south. I won't find any work here. Civilization. What the hell do they need a witcher here for? When I ask after employment, they look at me as if I'm a freak."
"What are you talking about? What civilization? I crossed Bowena a week ago and heard all sorts of stories as I rode through the country. Apparently there are water sprites here. Myriapodons, chimeri, flying drakes, every possible filth. You should be up to your ears in work."
"Stories, well, I've heard them too. Half of them are either made up or exaggerated. No, Dandelion. The world is changing. Something's coming to an end."
The poet took a long pull at the demijohn, narrowed his eyes and sighed heavily. "Are you crying over your sad fate as a witcher again, and philosophizing on top of that? I perceive the disastrous effects of inappropriate literature, because the fact that the world is changing occurred even to that old fart, Roderick de Novembre. The changeability of the world is, as it happens, the only thesis in this treatise you can agree with. but it's not so innovative you have to ply me with it and put on the face of a great thinker, which doesn't suit you in the least. Instead of answering, Geralt took a sip from the demijohn.
Yes, yes, sighed Dandelion anew. The world is changing. The sun sets and the vodka is coming to an end.
What else, in your opinion, is coming to an end? You mentioned something about endings, philosopher.
I'll give you a couple of examples, said Geralt after a moment's silence. All from 2 months this side of the Boena. One day, I ride up, and what do I see? A bridge. And under that bridge sits a troll, and demands every passerby pays him. Those who refuse have a leg injured, sometimes both. So I go to the alderman. How much will you give me for that troll? He's amazed. What are you talking about? He asks. Who will repair the bridge if the troll's not there? He repairs it regularly, with the sweat of his brow. Solid work, first rate. It's cheaper to pay his toll. So I ride on. And what do I see? A fork tail. Not very big, about 4 yards, nose tip to tail tip. It's flying, carrying a sheep in its talons. I go to the village. How much, I ask, will you pay me for the fork tail? The peasants fall on their knees. No, they shout. It's our baron's youngest daughter's favourite dragon. If a scale falls from its back, the baron will burn our hamlet and skin us. I ride on, and I'm getting hungrier and hungrier. I ask around for work. Certainly it's there. But what work? To catch a Rosalka for one man, a nymph for another, a dryad for a third. They've gone completely mad. The villages are teeming with girls, but they want humanoids. Another asked me to kill a Micopteran and bring him a bone from its hand because, crushed and poured into a soup, it cures impotence. That's rubbish, interrupted Dandelion. I tried it. It doesn't strengthen anything, and it makes the soup taste of old socks. But if people believe it and are inclined to pay, I'm not going to kill Micopterans, nor any other harmless creatures. Then you'll go hungry, unless you change your line of work.
To what?
Whatever. Become a priest. You wouldn't be mad at it with all your scruples, your morality, your knowledge of people and everything. The fact that you don't believe in any gods shouldn't be a problem. I don't know many priests who do. Become a priest and stop feeling sorry for yourself.
I'm not feeling sorry for myself. I'm stating the facts.
Dandelion crossed his legs and examined his worn soul with interest.
You remind me, Geralt, of an old fisherman who, towards the end of his life, discovers that fish stink and the breeze from the sea makes your bones ache. Be consistent. Talking and regretting won't get you anywhere. If I were to find that the demand for poetry had come to an end, I'd hang up my lute and become a gardener. I'd grow roses.
Nonsense. You're not capable of giving it up.
Well, agreed the poet, still staring at his soul. Maybe not. But our professions differ somewhat. The demand for poetry and the sound of lute strings will never decline. It's worse with your trade. You witchers, after all, deprive yourselves of work, slowly but surely. The better and the more conscientiously you work, the less work there is for you. After all, your goal is a world without monsters, a world which is peaceful and safe, a world where witches are unnecessary. A paradox, isn't it?
True.
In the past, when unicorns still existed, there was quite a large group of girls who took care of their virtue in order to be able to hunt them. Do you remember? And the rat catchers with pipes? Everybody was fighting over their services, but they were finished off by alchemists and their effective poisons, and then domesticated ferrets and weasels. The little animals were cheaper, nicer, and didn't guzzle so much beer. Notice the analogy?
I do.
So, use other people's experiences. The unicorn virgins, when they lost their jobs, immediately popped their cherry. Some, eager to make up for the years of sacrifice, became famous far and wide for their technique and zeal. The rat catchers? Well, you better not copy them, because they, to a man, took to drink and went to the dogs. Well, now it looks as if the time's come for witches. You're reading Roderick de Novembre? As far as I remember, there are mentions of witches there, of the first ones who started work some 300 years ago. In the days when the peasants used to go to reap the harvest in armed bands, when villages were surrounded by a triple stockade, when merchant caravans looked like the march of regular troops and loaded catapults stood on the ramparts of the few towns night and day. Because it was us, human beings, who were the intruders here.
This land was ruled by dragons, manticores, griffins and amphisbenas, vampires and werewolves, strigger, kikimoras, chimeri and flying drakes. And this land had to be taken from them bit by bit, every valley, every mountain.